Good morning, everyone. You are very welcome to our service. Welcome to everyone who is joining us via our webcam and to those listening to us through our recordings page on our website. My name is Gavin Byrne, and I am the minister of this congregation. So let us begin our weekly gathering of prayer, worship, and companionship with a reflection on the changing season. Consider winter's chill, when all was still, with seed and plant lying dormant, followed by the rising sun and the warming air of spring, green shoots emerging, leaves unfurling, blossom shouting its praise to the Creator. And now the beauty of a late spring day. We bless you, God of seed and harvest, and we bless each other that the beauty of this world and the love that created it might be expressed through our lives and be a blessing to others, now and always. Amen. And now we will light our chalice, symbol of our free Unitarian faith. As we travel the paths that our lives reveal to us, we are often not sure of the way, the distance, or the destination. Nevertheless, we have each other. We can look to one another for wisdom. We can be grateful for each other's companionship, and we can seek support when we have lost hope. We light our chalice this morning to signify that we are willing to take the journey together. And this morning we draw once more into our minds and our hearts those living through violence and fear throughout the world. So now let us open our hymn books to hymn number 287. Faith of the Larger Liberty. Now, holding on to our hymn books, let us read together the words that express all that brings us together as a loving Unitarian community. And it's number 471 in our hymn book. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve human need, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. And our first reading this morning will be read by Janet.
Morning, everybody. For today's reading, I am reading from a book that was introduced to us by Pam during her Wednesday meditations. The title of the book is 99 Names of God. It's a wonderful little book, and it suggests to us lots of ideas about how we may understand God, or as I would rather think, a goodness or goodness. The few lines I'm going to read talk about prayer and the value of prayer and whether to pray or not to pray. It suggests in praying we open up a degree of trust. And in that trusting, we can be calmed down. And when we are calmed down, we are open to the possibility of hope. The title is God, the Guardian and Keeper. From what is God, the Guardian, actually guarding me? Certainly not from the blows of fate. which hit all of us, whether we place ourselves under God's guardianship or it never even occurs to us to do so. And yet, all who flee from the heat of life's harshest moments into the protective shade of God attest to the fact that under the guard of God, they were able to cool their heads and breathe a little easier. So what then does that difference consist of? Whether or not we know ourselves to be guarded by God, the external circumstances remain the same. What stands the test is our inner attitude of trust. Not because we are fooling ourselves and telling ourselves what we want to hear. No, our trust in God is proved right because it guards us from desperation. Our trust in God is proved right because it guards us from desperation. Desperation makes us blind to the possibilities that, despite everything, are still open to us. Trust, however, opens our eyes and lets us discover unsuspected paths forward. In this, God reveals himself as the guardian. He works upon us not from the outside in, but from the innermost depths of the mystery in which our life is rooted. Who around me is having a particularly difficult time right now and may need my guardianship? Instead of talking about the guardian, let us silently enter into the protective shade of the divine mystery together.
So it's time for the story for our children and young people. So you know the score, guys. Do you want to come up and join me? My story this morning, it's called The Three Questions, and it's by a guy called John Muth, but he based it on a Russian story by Leo Tolstoy. Yes, sir.
John Muth,
well, he's a writer, and he took an old story by Leo Tolstoy. Did you ever hear of Leo Tolstoy?
No.
He's a wonderful Russian writer, okay? So, this is a kind of a once upon a time. So once upon a time, in a beautiful village, there lived a kind boy named Nikolai. Now, he was curious, and he always wanted to know the answers to some of life's biggest questions. Now, one day, he decided, do you know what? I need to find out the answers to three particularly important questions. And he thought that would help him be a really good and better person. So the three questions were, number one, what is the best time to do things? What is the best time to do things? Number two, who is the most important one? Who is the most important one? And the third question is, what is the right thing to do? So, Nikolai thought long and hard about these questions, but he didn't have the answers. He didn't know the answers to his questions. So he decided to set off on a journey and to seek wisdom from some very, very wise people. So first he went to visit his friend, the wise owl. And the owl lived in a very tall tree. And the owl told him that the best time to do things is now. It's important to act in the present because tomorrow might never come. And waiting can lead to missed opportunities. So Nikolai felt inspired by this answer, and he thanked the owl for his wisdom. So next he went to see a wise old turtle by the river. Now the turtle shared that the most important person is the one you are with. The most important person is the one you are with right now. Okay? And why is that? That means that when you're with someone, whether it's a friend or a family member or even a stranger, they deserve your full attention and care.
Do you agree with that? The person you're with now. So Nikolai nodded and understood that being present with others is what truly matters. Finally then, Nikolai sought the wisdom of a kind-hearted fox. And the fox said that the right thing to do is simply to help others. By being kind and lending a hand, you make the world a better place. So Nikolai's heart was filled with warmth and he realized how simple, yet how powerful this message was. So with his heart brimming with this new knowledge, Nikolai went home and he was really excited to share what he had learned. But on his way home, he stumbled upon a girl crying by the road. And the girl's name was Sasha, and she had lost her favorite toy, and she was really upset. So Nikolai remembered what the fox said about helping others. So Nikolai rushed to her side. "Don't worry, Sasha, I'll help you find your toy." And together they searched everywhere, under the bushes and around the trees, and finally they spotted the toy stuck in a branch. I think the owl might have taken it. Anyway, Sasha's face lit up with joy and she hugged Nikolai tightly. Thank you so much for finding my toy. And in that moment, Nikolai felt quite happy and quite fulfilled. He realized that he was living the answers to the three questions. He had acted in the present, in the now, by helping Sasha. He had shown that she was the most important person in that moment, and he had done the right thing by helping to find the toy. So from that day on, Nikolai continued to embrace the wisdom he had gained. And every time he faced a challenge, he remembered the three questions that guided him. Act now, value everyone around you, and always choose kindness. The end. So that's our story. So do you want to head back? I think there's Sunday Club this morning. Great. Have a lovely time and we'll see you later on. Okay. And for the rest of us, let us turn to 163, "For the Earth Forever Turning." My reading is a little bit of history, and I guess it's something I wrote, and it's part of my that famed history assignment that I had to do for Unitarian College. So hopefully it's worth a retelling. While Western Europe in the 16th century was largely occupied with the bloody business of the Inquisition and the precursor to the 30 Years' War, a radical experiment in pluralism was unfolding in the hills of Transylvania. In January 1668, the Diet of Torda issued a decree that would become the cornerstone of human rights and freedom of conscience, the Edict of Torda. Now, at the time, the prevailing rule in Europe was whose realm, whose religion? And this refers to a 16th century legal principle where the ruler, the king, the sovereign, determines the religion of their subjects. Now, Transylvania broke the mold, and under the leadership of King John Sigismund, who was, incidentally, the only Unitarian monarch in history so far, and his court preacher, Ferenc David, the edict moved beyond mere permission or tolerance to exist. It asserted a profound theological and legal principle that faith is a gift from God. Now, the edict didn't grant modern anything-goes secularism, but it was light years ahead of its neighbors. Its primary provisions included, one, freedom of the pulpit. Preachers were allowed to explain the Gospels according to their own understanding. Number two, congregational sovereignty. If the community didn't like what a preacher was saying, they had the right to hire a different one.
And thirdly, prohibition of violence. No one could be imprisoned, banished, or reviled for their religious teaching. The law officially recognized four received religions: the Roman Catholic religion, Lutheranism, Reformed Calvinism, and Unitarian. And while it left the Eastern Orthodox population in a tolerated but legally inferior status, it effectively stopped the state-sponsored cycle of burning heretics at the site. Now, the king died in 1571, just 3 years after the edict, and he died in a hunting accident. And his successor, Stephen Bathory, was a Roman Catholic, and unfortunately, he sought to curtail the spread of this religious innovation. Ferenc David himself eventually died in a prison cell after his theology was deemed too radical even for the new status quo. Now, despite all of this, the spirit of Torda survived, and it survives to this day. It transformed Transylvania into a haven for heretics, providing a sanctuary for thinkers who were being hunted elsewhere in Europe. And today, the edict is celebrated not just as a religious or historical document, but as an early ancestor to the idea that your conscience was free. And it also stands as the beginning of modern separation of church and state. It reminds us that even in the most dogmatic eras, there were those brave enough to suggest that belief cannot be coerced by either sword or the law. And it reminds us that the sacred space of the human heart and mind is a territory that no government or external authority has the right to conquer. So the Edict of Torda. For our reflection and time of silence this morning, I'd like you to take on this challenge. Perhaps get as comfortable as you can in your seat. Take long, deep breaths and relax. Let us, in the quiet of our minds, speak fond words for those to whom we are close and who are close to us. For those whose presence is now a memory. For fond friends and helpful neighbors. And let us, in the quiet of our minds, speak fond words for those we too often forget, for those who are struggling with poverty, with tyranny, or with disaster. For those who seek work, who seek a home or better health. For those who are discriminated against because of who they are. And let us, in the quiet of our minds, try speaking fond words for those for whom we find it difficult to speak fond words. For those whom we never see, but on whom we depend. For those who irritate us, because they are only doing their job. and for those with whom we are out of sorts. And let us, in the quiet of our minds, just hope that someone else is speaking fond words for those whom we cannot love and who are unlovely to us, for those whom we have forgotten, hard words will break no bones, but more than bones are broken by the inescapable stones of fond words left unspoken. Thank you, Josh. Today I'm going to talk about social media, artificial intelligence, and consider what are the implications of the development of these powerful technologies in our lives. There are many positives to speak of, but there are also threats to our freedoms. We have some sovereignty, and that space of freedom is our consciousness. It's this private space where we can decide what we want to think about. Yet increasingly, we're thinking the thoughts of algorithms or the thoughts of other people. So says the author Michael Pollan, who writes about consciousness. So to what extent are we at risk of handing over the sovereignty of our minds and hearts to machines, to artificial intelligence, and allowing what we come across on social media to influence how we understand the world? Did you ever have the feeling that your mother didn't want you hanging around with certain people because they might be a bad influence on you? Well, we're all at risk of hanging around with the people who might be a bad influence on us. But it's not on the street corners or in the disco. It's on the small screens. And our small screens are full of them. We do risk falling under their influence. We risk giving up our freedom to think for ourselves, the foundational freedom upon which all other freedoms are built and depend. During the recent fuel protests, I stumbled upon a few videos on social media. They recounted the tragic story of a farmer who had died after participating in the protests in Dublin. He reportedly returned home after the fuel protest and died in tragic circumstances. Now, those videos were heartbreaking, showing men deeply upset and inconsolably broken as they shared the story of a man who couldn't see any way through this cost of living crisis. However, the truth was that no incident occurred. There was no farmer who died in those circumstances. I suspect the men who posted those videos didn't realize this. They trusted the news they read on their social media feeds and shared their emotional and angry reactions with the world. These men were expressing their empathy and their sorrow, offering condolences to a man's family. They also called for continued protest and stronger opposition to what they believed is government inaction on the cost of living. It wasn't a simple case of disinformation leading to misinformation. It was deliberate deception and manipulation. The intention was to create maximum protest by any means necessary. And if I can create the greatest rage, it will lead to the greatest reaction. And if I can throw into that rage anti-immigrant sentiment, homophobia, transphobia, misogyny, and whatever you're having yourself, all the better. Here we risk surrendering the freedom to be decent, dignified, and truthful. Staying on the subject of misinformation and disinformation, there's two stories going around social media relating to David Attenborough and two prominent people, the Mayor of London and the White House Press Secretary. Attenborough apparently had some disagreement with them and, of course, emerged a hero by his expert debating skills. It was all fake news. Nothing happened. Now, as a result of my opening and reading these stories, the algorithm, which I'll talk about in a second, is feeding me more and more the same. So when I open up my Facebook later, I'm going to see more about this fake news. At best, some of these stories demonstrates our deep empathy for people's struggles, but it also highlights how easily we can relinquish our freedoms. How do we discern what's real and what's fake? Algorithms, you might have heard of those. It's a key process working under the hood of social media and the internet in general. And its purpose is to capture and hold our attention to the end that I will click on a product and buy something. But algorithms also work to capture my attention towards a particular worldview, to the end that I will be influenced. Now, it can achieve a number of things. My opinions will be changed, or my existing biases will be cemented, baked in, given credence, acknowledged, confirmed, and affirmed. Now, to explain how they work as easily as I can, we could take a simple example. So I open the internet and I do a search for a clothing brand to find a specific shirt. I find it and I complete a purchase. Great. However, the next time I check my social media or browse the internet, I will see ads for shirts and shops selling them. If I've watched a video of a protest, which happened, I will be given more videos of protests. So the algorithm analyzes your past behavior, your likes and your clicks, and then will feed you content based on those clicks, likes, or searches. And the goal isn't just to show you content, it's also to show you content that will keep you on the app for as long as possible, scrolling, scrolling, scrolling. I missed my bus stop last week because of this. I worked for a couple of years on an internet safety program for young people. As you know, I was a youth worker for many years. Now, the internet safety program was divided into short modules for use in a youth work setting. And it dealt head on with the good, the bad, and the ugly of the online world. Its purpose was to enable young people navigate the online world. But the magic was that it was facilitated in a trusting, non-formal youth work setting where trusted adults engage young people in conversations and activities on something young people are very interested in. And if serious issues arose, the adult in the room could respond and support a particularly vulnerable young person. Also, the young people engaged voluntarily. It wasn't like school. Now, it's all very well to have programs to deal with issues that young people have to confront on a daily basis, but risks will remain, and not every young person will have access to these programs. Now, on a positive note, young people do find some very fulfilling and positive online communities. It can be particularly crucial for young people who are isolated. Young people can find their tribe. But numerous court rulings around the world have found that social media companies intentionally design their platforms to be addictive to children, leading to serious mental health issues like depression, anxiety, and body dysmorphia. Last month, the European Commission issued a preliminary finding against a particular social media company for failing to prevent children under 13 using their networks. And that is in breach of the Digital Services Act. And this week, you might have noticed, it was on the agenda in the Oireachtas. Now, social media companies, in fairness, deny that their products are harmful, and they tell us that they are working hard to make online spaces safe for children and young people. But they also admit that not every piece of harmful content will be filtered out. They admit that children and young people will be exposed to harmful content. But we must do better. It is my contention that society as a whole is failing to protect young people from harm. And it isn't just a problem for young people. My recent experience of viewing content related to the fuel protests shows this. We are all vulnerable. So I'd like to talk about how we might begin to protect young people from the harms associated with social media. And as parents, as guardians, as carers, as anyone who works with young people, there's a few things we can do. One key safety measure we can do is to provide young people with real-world experiences where the smartphone or tablet is not required. Another is to set clear rules around online time. because you are in charge. Better still, delay allowing children have a smart device in their hands. But talk to your children, engage them about the online world. Another idea is to gather all the parents in the school, create a community to talk about this and start early. Perhaps agree a code about when a smartphone may eventually find its way into the hands of your children. But probably most crucially of all, model good behavior. So what about AI or artificial intelligence? Throughout history, humanity has always sought more knowledge and a better understanding of the world. And at best, new technology is beneficial. For example, look at the advances in medical science that have led to longer and healthier lives. And AI is playing no small part in this. Think of what the pencil, the printing press, the telescope have done for human advancement. Once upon a time, the only job was survival, and we transitioned from hunter-gatherers to farmers and toolmakers. This shift created new roles like blacksmiths, basket makers, and potters. Then there was time for creativity, allowing for pursuits such as music, art, writing, poetry. Onwards and upwards, forward through the ages, and here we are today. People are now paid to play video games. They're paid to dine out and review wonderful restaurants, and they are paid to travel to exotic places and tell us all about them. What would our parents, our grandparents, have thought of that? And once cherished professions are now jobs at risk. Job disruption has been a constant in human evolution, and the rapid development of artificial intelligence is displacing jobs at, some say, an unprecedented rate. Vlad Tenev is a technological entrepreneur, and he has considered this issue. And he talks at length about the extraordinary growth of artificial intelligence. And he notes a recurring feeling of exceptionalism across generations. People, and I don't think we're any different, believe that we are at the point of discontinuity, where history ends and a new world begins with no precedent. Now, this could be true this time. We don't know if we're building a super assistant or an apex predator. However, being hypervigilant about threats to our survival is a key part of our survival mechanism and evolution. It's what makes us human. And Vlad offers some straightforward yet valuable advice for young people and their parents who are concerned about future job prospects. He advises against letting predictions of job disruption prevent you from pursuing something you are passionate about, and I concur. Follow your passions and interests for greater fulfillment and happiness. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, acknowledges AI's potential to tackle complex challenges. It enhances education and healthcare. It drives scientific innovation, and it is an extraordinary assistant when it comes to climate action. However, it also highlights risk to privacy, to safety, to security, and human autonomy, freedom. Free will must be considered at this point. Free will is the sovereignty we possess above all other ideas and opinions. And when we're simply thinking the thoughts of others fed to us by those insidious algorithms, we begin to relinquish that sovereignty. We are biological beings, thankfully. Feelings and instincts remain powerful human traits no technology can replicate or replace. However, humans can manipulate those feelings and instincts and masterfully use technology to do so. Those men I mentioned at the beginning of this address, who were genuinely and deeply moved by an untrue story about a tragic event linked to the fuel protests, they were shamelessly manipulated. People did it, and technology merely enabled it. And I have become extra cautious when encountering stories that move me. I know that the freedoms I enjoy in this society can only be dreamed of by those in other parts of the world. But often I fear that I live in a kind of curated cocoon. While I believe I'm seeing the world for what it is, I might be trapped in that comfortable prison of my own existing biases. I'm protected and I'm happy in my own echo chamber. We are all at risk of unknowingly surrendering our freedoms. Freedom is our consciousness, that private space where we can decide what we want to think about. Now, a caveat. This community is on social media, hoping the algorithms will capture the attention of some spiritual seekers out there and drawing them into our Unitarian space. Before coming through that door, people will generally first check us out online. They will look at our social media. They will look at our website. Before I walked through those doors, I did. So we need to be there. It's one of our shop windows. But I must say, what kept me coming week after week was a real-world experience, not something given to me online. It was the welcomers that Sunday morning. And I can't emphasize how important welcomers at the door are. So thank you to all who do that Sunday after Sunday. I mentioned the bad, the good, and the ugly of the online world, but I want to focus on the good for a moment. I want to quote a letter that appeared in the Irish Times last year, and I quote, "Sir, I refer to the octogenarian John Burnett's letter in Thursday's Irish Times, where he comments that he's too busy looking out on the world to allow his smartphone to dominate his life. I don't allow that either, but as a mainly housebound nonagenarian, that is someone in their 90s, mine does play a hugely important part in my life. My family literally keep me in the picture. In the last fortnight, I've attended a wedding in Scotland, another in Italy, and yesterday, oh joy, I met my newborn great-granddaughter in England for the first time. No wonder my smartphone provides such a bonus window on my world. I'd be lost without it. Yours, etc., Jane Meredith." Yes, that's our beloved Jane Meredith. Hello, Jane. I hope you're with us online this morning. So, our online networks can be so important to us for all the reasons Jane mentions. So, to conclude, may we defend the freedom of our minds. You are free to disagree, to agree, to disbelieve, and to question. You're free to reject the premise of a story or a statement and anything that insults your soul. Our window here honors and celebrates human effort in science, in human compassion, and the pursuit of truth. So may we always honor and celebrate human effort in science, compassion, and the pursuit of truth. And may we always protect our freedom, never surrendering it to those who would seek to manipulate our inner goodness. Amen. Now let us sing hymn number 111, Life of Ages. Our notices. Firstly, thank you to everyone who contributed to our service this morning. Everyone is invited to join the congregation downstairs for tea and coffee. You are most welcome, particularly if you are a visitor or this is your first time here. A Ukrainian woman is seeking accommodation from early July. She is studying English and can provide references from her current host. She's also seeking employment. Now, the host family will receive up to 600 euro per month under the Government Accommodation Recognition Payment Scheme, and that runs out in March 2027. So please speak to Maud Robinson if you are in a position to help. Our weekly service of reflection in the church continues this and every Wednesday from 1:05 p.m. to 1:35 p.m. Our annual plant sale is today downstairs after the service, and all proceeds from the sale of plants will be for Christian Aid. Also today, busy day today, Liz McManus will launch her new book, Tiny Bruises. It's at 3:00 here in the church, and all are invited. There will be wine. But you have to buy a book. The next Heart and Soul session will be on Monday, the 18th of May at 7:30 p.m. here in the vestry. And once more, you're asked to reserve your space with Shari. The last Sundays at 2 concert of the summer, anyway, of the year, will take place on Sunday, the 24th of May at 2 p.m. here in the church. While free tickets are on Eventbrite, you may wish to make a voluntary contribution, which will go towards the continued maintenance of our church. Sunday Club volunteers, we were to have a meeting after the service today, but things have changed. But however, I'd still like to meet you for a chat after the service in the vestry, directly after the service. It's really going to be a meeting about a meeting, so I'm sorry about that. But it's about the Sunday Club and its future, and we're going to dream some dreams about how we might enhance the programme into the future. Josh Shari and Marion Creeley will have a free lunchtime recital in Sandford Road Church of Ireland on Friday at 1 p.m., so something to do on Friday. There will be a managing committee meeting tomorrow evening at 7:30 on Zoom. And finally, all of these notices will be posted in our weekly email from Josh, and if you wish to receive that newsletter, please give your email address to Josh. So now, let us sing our final hymn number 76, in honour of the plant sale, for flowers that bloom about our feet. We have a calling in this world. We are called to honour diversity, to respect differences with dignity, and to challenge those who would forbid it. We are people of a wide path. Let us be wide in affection. And now let us go our way in peace. Amen.